This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
Is another apocalyptic prediction about to come true? Winds of death sweep across the world, and whole continents will be cast adrift in an ocean of blood.
Hi, I'm Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, action, exploitation, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1970s to today. Be sure and check out reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, interviews, lists, and terrific movie giveaways.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's a special episode of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, 55B, a discussion in the movie Killer Rack. On the line, we have director Greg Lamberson, co-star Paul McGinnis, and writer star Jennifer Swolak and star Michael Thurber. They joined us on the line from the Queen City, Buffalo, New York, and from Rhode Island.
All you need's a pair of fun bags, and you'll never be a fag, hey!
They're preppy! They make me very happy. They make me want to bust out into song.
All you need's a pair of fun bags, a pair of knockers to make Dutch gag.
I'm scouting the mountains for lactose fountains, memories to make Rushmeyer cry.
The sight of your breasts makes me quake. I don't even care that they're fake.
My heart and soul are yearning to feel. I know if I can touch them, they're real.
Woohoo! All you need's a pair of fun bags, a pair of cacas that will not sag.
We call them whoppers, poppers, big gobstoppers, Godzillas that will crush you in your sleep.
All you need's a pair of fun bags, a leather teddy and a ball gag.
Bazoomas, palookas, guns like bazookas, BS puppies pushing in your puss. How's that for alliteration?
All you need's a pair of fun bags. All you need's a pair of fun bags. All you need's a pair of fun bags. All you need's a pair of fun bags.
Congratulations on making an incredibly entertaining movie. Chris and I have had the pleasure of seeing it numerous times. In fact, right now we can't get the that darn fun bag song out of our head. Excellent, excellent movie.
It's the most addicting song ever written.
This song haunted my dreams for weeks.
I can imagine. Now, the film will be having its world premiere at the ScareCon Film Festival on Friday, September 11th in Verona, New York. How excited are you guys to finally unveil Killer Rack to the public?
Like our babies are going out into the world. Extremely excited.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm very anxious to see it as part of a group of people who have no emotional attachment to it. So just to hear that, you know, the acceptance of strangers is what I'm longing for. Jessica's excited for us. She won't be there.
Yeah, I can be there, Jessica.
Yes, I'm sure.
She'll be in our hearts and thoughts. It will be the first time any of my films has screened in a casino, though, so that's kind of exciting.
So
the annual convention is held in the Turning Stone Casino Resort.
So hopefully there won't be anybody getting up to
Dead
go to the
black.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say hopefully nobody's going to get up and go to the background table while the film is playing. You've been an indie filmmaker for decades now, right?
3 decades.
Yeah, you started with Slime City. You've also done
Slime City was my first film in '86, but mm-hmm. I started working on indie horror films in 1984 with I Was a Teenage Zombie.
Ooh.
And I kept working on other films and alternating them with my own. I worked on Frankenlotter's Brain Damage, mm-hmm. and a film
yep.
called Plutonium Baby.
Awesome.
Did a couple of films that were even more obscure than Slime City, and then I came out to Buffalo to be an author, but I kept making films, mm-hmm. so I haven't quite been able to quit.
Right, and you've also made Slum City Massacre, Dry Bones. Now, and this is all a question for all of you guys, I know that indie filmmaking is a tough, rigorous pursuit, a lot of long hours, but this film in particular, Killer Rack, has such a palpable sense of fun, and I want to ask you, actually I'll ask you, Jessica, was it as fun to make as it is to watch?
Yes. It was a lot of fun. First, the group of people that I was able to work with are very enjoyable to be around, so that helped. I've been friends with Paul for a while, and I got to know Greg already from working with him before, so Greg's really a great person to work for. And so just the nature of the script itself and the effects and the dialogue and the other actors made it extremely fun, the film. So even though, you know, we had long hours, it didn't really feel like that a lot of the time because it was just the material itself is so much fun and it's hilarious, so.
Greg, did you have a good time on the set?
I have a good time when the shoot is over. Generally, I just have so much responsibility the whole time that I find things to amuse myself, but I'm always worrying about something.
Obviously,
yeah. It was a very good shoot, though. I mean, of all the shoots I've been on, Slime City Massacre, and this one were by far the best. And for this one, Paul and our other partner, Rod Durek, and I worked very hard to put together the right cast and the right crew, and everything went really well.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I want to, that's a good segue to talk to Paul, because Paul, I mean, you wrote the script for this one, am I correct?
Correct.
And in addition to writing it, you're also the casting director.
Yes, Greg and I work hand in hand in that. We went back and forth when he first told me he wanted to direct it. That's one of the first things we did was we talked about cast and we threw ideas around. Prior to Greg stepping on, I had written a script a while ago and I thought, oh, maybe this would be fun to make. And we had some people read for it. And so I had an idea of who I wanted, but when I got Greg involved, we had upped our game a little bit. So it was really interesting. A lot of original cast made it through, but there were some new faces, some new people who had gotten involved that were just amazing.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners, why don't you summarize Killer Rack in, let's say, 3 or 4 sentences?
Killer Rack is about a woman who is unhappy with her appearance, so she goes to get herself altered, enhanced, if you will, and she goes to the wrong person who implants man-eating creatures within her, and she has to learn to accept herself and somehow fight the creatures.
Right, and this, of course, she goes to the incredible Dr. Thulu, played by the incomparable Debbie Rochon, who's unbelievably great in this movie. And Greg, you've worked.
The funny thing about that was when I wrote the script, way before I ever imagined Greg would get involved in it, as I was writing, I'm like, who would be my ideal as I was writing the character? Like, who would be. So I wrote it with, like, Debbie Rochon or Debbie Rochon-esque actress in mind, never imagining I would ever get Debbie Rochon. So when Greg and I sat down to talk about the first thing, he said, you know, who would be good for this part is Debbie. Mm-hmm. And I just almost hit the ground.
And the reason that I suggested Debbie, besides the fact that I had worked with her before because she had a big part in Slime City Massacre and she was on Dry Bones, I asked her on Slime City Massacre, what is the one part you haven't played that you'd really like to play? And she said, a mad scientist. So in the very first scene, I was like, oh, this is obviously going to be Debbie when I read the first scene of the script.
Well, speaking about the cast, I mean, the casting is impeccable. I mean, the only quibble I would have with the casting is the guy that you picked to play Tim. Yeah, that guy was not
good. I know, he was a diva from the day one.
Yeah.
I couldn't shake him. He came with a script.
Totally wrong for the role, in my opinion. That would be you, Paul, of course, right?
Oh, well, I didn't watch the movie, I don't know.
No? Okay, well, you actually...
I haven't seen it now. It's not really my thing.
And, Paul, how did you connect with Greg? And how did you go about, like... Were you trying to hustle it elsewhere? No offense, but like in the traditional, you know, means, like going to hustling it in Hollywood or God knows where.
No, actually, it was very kismet. I got to work with Greg. I was an extra on Slime City Massacre, and I was a stage actor who's always had a love of this kind of movie. And so I worked with Greg on other stuff, and then I got involved in Dry Bones. Mm-hmm. And during one day we're shooting, we were just another actor
director on there was talking about his project, and it was brought up to Greg, and I said, hey, Greg, you know, actually somebody else had said, you know, Paul got a script you should read, and he read it and then called me later and said, we need to talk. So it was. I did not push it on Greg. He knew the script existed due to it was submitted to a festival that Greg runs called Buffalo Dreams, mm-hmm. and actually won for best script, but Greg didn't read it. Greg wasn't involved in that part of it. So by the time he finally read it, he said he wanted to direct it, which was just awesome.
I laughed out loud reading the script beginning to end, and then I reread it, and I laughed out loud again. And I just knew that I knew how to make this particular film. And it didn't hurt that Paul had written all sorts of references to Slime City in there anyway. So I definitely felt like it was kindred material.
And that was written before I ever thought Greg was going to get involved. So that was not, that was unconscious kissing up, as it were.
And Debbie involved, you know, she came up to shoot Dry Bones a year before we did Killer Rack, and we asked her to read the script, and she recorded a little video for our first crowdfunding campaign. And she told me at that time, she said she was trying to make sure I understood that whoever played the lead role of Betty, who's in 90% of the film, was going to have to be really good to be able to carry the film. So casting that part next was the biggest thing we had to do. And it was Paul who suggested Jessica, who he had acted opposite in Dry Bones. And Jessica was only on Dry Bones for 2 or 3 days, and most of her time was spent climbing out of bed at an angle so that we couldn't see she was wearing underwear. So we didn't really have a lot of conversations at shoot. She would sit in the corner quietly until she was up. But Paul was her advocate, and obviously I'm thrilled that we went that route.
Well, Jessica, I mean, you were...
She is a diva.
Well, Jessica, whether you're a diva or not, I mean, you are absolutely, I mean, I guess obviously you're the linchpin that this whole film sort of revolves around, and you're nothing if not utterly charming and just wonderful in this movie. Funny, committed.
Oh, thank you.
You know,
thank
you're,
I appreciate that.
Oh, it's just...
There could be no living with her now.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I can hear the ego inflating.
This is the rock of the superstardom. So I want to ask you, Jessica, since we talked about you, you know, when we first meet your character, you're basically getting ignored by a couple of hilarious catcalling metalheads, and
yes.
You know, you're this very sweet, very caring, very innocent, let's say naive young lady, but very self-conscious due to insecurities, and I'd say, you know, superficialities, i.e. your breast size. Paul, by the way, congratulations on writing the most euphemisms for flat-chested I've ever seen in one film. I mean...
And the thing is, I've missed some. After the thing, I'm like, oh, I should have used that joke, too. So I'm writing down boob references all the time now, just in case. It's good.
Oh, I mean, it's like, you're built like a Ken doll. It's like filling up a 10-year-old boy. That's a great top you have on. Too bad they don't make them for women. Just get this coat rack off me. Quicksand chest. I can go on and on and on. But back to you, Jessica. Your character conveyed a lot of vulnerability at the beginning. How did you reach into yourself and bring out that vulnerability?
Well, in case anybody hasn't noticed, I grew up with a very, you know, undersized chest myself. So, funny enough, when I first read the script, I actually, like, joked with Paul because some of the stuff that was said to her, actually, people have made jokes about me in the same way. Like, I think the only difference I actually had, I don't know if I'm sharing too much, but I had an ex-boyfriend of mine joke with me, he's like, you're built like a 12-year-old boy. And so it was actually very close to the Dutch line where it feels like I'm feeling like a 10-year-old boy. So I could identify a little bit with, personally identify a little bit with Betty herself, just because, you know, it made it, I think, a little bit easier character-wise, the fact that I already have a small chest, so, you know, I could identify in that way. I never felt like it held me back. So that part, you know, I just had to kind of look into, you know, I really liked the character right away, and it was pretty, I don't know, it was easy to kind of get involved in her mindset, and the transition of her attitude once she got the implant. And so, you know, I don't know, I just found things to identify with, mm-hmm. And you know, just become the character, I suppose.
Just before I forget, the two metalheads that accost you there in the beginning, it's sort of a neat little thread that ties Slime City together with this, because Ghetto Blasters feature prominently in both, and that's one of my favorite scenes in Slime City. I was wondering, Greg, like, what the inspiration was for these two rocker, like, sleazebags?
Well, totally. They were totally written in the script. I mean, I came to this, and the script was largely what came to the screen. Like any director, you know, I made suggestions here or there, and like any writer, Paul took them. And all the characters were exactly what was written in the script. We had a lot of conversations about them. We had a lot of conversations about casting. And
they were terrific.
Saw them as sort of like, you know, the guys from Clerks hanging outside the
studio. Yeah, definitely.
But obviously, that's not their personalities.
But there is that slight Jay, Silent and Bob vibe to them, just the fact they kind of just do nothing and go nowhere. Yeah, definitely.
They look like big Rush fans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are all those alleys and stuff like that, and visually it does have a kinship to Slime City, obviously. Mm-hmm. But all those characters were Paul's.
Hmm. Well, you know, I want to ask, because I definitely want to talk about the references, because, I mean, this film is like chock-a-block with references, and, you know, Paul and Greg, we got you for the whole hour, but Jessica, we don't have you for that long, so I want to ask you another question, and that is that, regarding your character, and again, maybe this is something that Paul wrote into the script, maybe this is something that you brought into the character, maybe this is something I'm reading into the character of Betty, but despite the fact that, you know, we're meant to, and of course we do sympathize and empathize with you, you know, being the one who's always passive for promotions and, you know, being a victim of all this superficiality, did I not detect just a wee bit of superficiality in your character yourself? And I'm talking about your relationship with your coworker Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I kept saying throughout the film that she's a cock tease.
You said it, not me. I mean, you know, here you are. I mean, you have this boyfriend, Dutch, who's, you know, a bit of a douchebag, for lack of a better term. And you have this wonderful guy. Again, I don't know who cast him. Terrible for the role, but Tim. And he's absolutely in love with you. And, you know, you sort of ignore him because why?
Yeah, Jessica, watch
the You know, I think there's layers to that because, you know, I think sometimes people who may have, and I'm not discounting superficiality, but, like, I think sometimes when people have, like, low, maybe they don't value themselves as much as they should, they tend to allow people, they tend to care for people for some reason that don't treat them well. And
exactly.
So,
mm-hmm.
Subconsciously, perhaps, you know, she's not, well, because she's with Dutch, and so she might not be thinking about Tim in that way at first, but, you know, there could be a level of not really valuing herself, and so maybe deep down somewhere she feels like she's not really deserving of someone who is a really good person to her and treats her well, so... You know, I think there might be some underlying levels of that, because that tends to happen. That some people they allow themselves to be treated how they, you know, maybe subconsciously how they feel about themselves.
You were kind when you said the character was a little naive. Paul and I have this conversation, and she's actually clueless.
Well, yeah.
not only does she think that getting the breast job is going to change her life, but if you think what her ultimate goal is, she wants the bigger boobs so she can go into work and flirt her way into a higher position.
Mm-hmm.
So her values are a little screwed up as well.
And that's why I added the little gag at the end when they have their happy kiss where she squeezes his tits.
Yeah, exactly. That was great. I mean, that's the whole thing, too. I mean, the movie is just filled. I mean, honestly, like, from the first minute to the last, I mean, there's you got, like, you know, sight gags, you got Easter eggs, you got just, it's chock-a-block with references. I mean, you know, you're paying, you're playing fast and loose with lots of, you know, genre conventions, cheeky references to many films, including, you know, the Mad Scientist movies with, you know, Dr. Cthulhu and Igor. There's a reference to Tim Burton's Batman. There's, like, references, callbacks to Die Hard, Lethal Weapon. You got the cops spouting useless exposition, and on and on and on and on. And, I mean, when I watched it today for my third time, I kept spotting new things.
That's great.
And, hey, Paul, was this all in the script, or...?
Like, probably 95% of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's just how my brain works anyways. I'm constantly referencing. I speak all in, like, movie and music references regardless. Hmm. So, they got peppered in, and, like Greg said, he threw some suggestions in that I definitely took because they were great, but he stuck to the heart of it. He kept my little references. I don't think he necessarily liked the comic book ones, but yeah, I did not enjoy the Marvel comics. I didn't enjoy it because I hate Marvel comics. But I'm a huge fanboy, so I had to at least throw a Spider-Man one in. So.
Is that because you're a DC guy, Greg, or you just hate comics in general?
The whole history of Marvel and the way they treated Jack Kirby and yeah. The way they're making billions of dollars now on the backs of these creators just... It's an issue with me.
I agree with you. I'm a comic fan, but a DC guy all the way. But hey, we'll just leave it at that.
As you said, I mean, there's tons of jokes, and my philosophy was no joke is too cheap, mm-hmm. and we should throw out everything we can, and different people will laugh at different jokes.
Jessica, was there a particular joke that was your favorite that you're kind of giggling about right now?
It just reminds me. There's a joke that Paul hates. He wrote it, but he hates it.
Oh, the pun. Oh, my God. I am so anti-pun, but it was there, and I could not do it. This would be the ending part.
Yes, the ending.
So we don't want to give that. I won't. It's a visual gag. That's all I'll say. And the, when I had first written the script, the ending wasn't happy. It actually had a very cruel ending, and I'm again not to spoil this one, but it was much darker, we'll just say that. And so Greg had said, you know, let's try a different approach to it. As I was rewriting it, I threw this scene in, and as I was doing it, I was like, I can't not make this joke. It's just so there. And as I was writing, I'm like, I hate it. It's so punny. And I'm like, well, who's going to say it? My character is the only one who can say it. So not only was it a horrible pun, I was the only one who could deliver it. So I told all my pun-loving friends that if I don't hear them laughing at that, I will hunt them down.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, speaking of puns, I mean...
Every take, I died a little inside when I had to say that one, but I think it'll get a good laugh. It looks good.
Speaking of puns, I mean, the movie has a couple killer songs, pun very much intended.
Mm-hmm.
Whose idea was it to make it into a quasi-musical?
Well, there's it's a two-part answer. The first is, we're friends with a husband and wife team, Kim Piazza, who choreographed the dance scene, mm-hmm. and Armand Petrie, who was... He was the main songwriter on some songs, and he collaborated with a guy named Joe Rosler on others, and they're both professional musicians and arrangers and studio engineers. And one day, Armand was bringing my daughter home from a babysitting adventure, and along the way, she wouldn't stop talking. And when they walked in the house, the first thing he said, and what you need to know about Armand is that he is a big horror fan and he used to record commentary tracks for Synapse. He walked through the door and he said, "Are you making a movie about killer boobs? I have to be a part of this." So I asked him right away to do a Killer Rack theme song. And in the script, there's the psychiatrist character that Lloyd Kaufman plays.
Yes.
And when I told Paul that I wanted three scenes for this character,
mm-hmm.
A beginning, a middle, and an end. And the second scene just felt to me when I read it like it should be a musical number. And Armand's wife then said to me that he was walking around the house singing, like, songs that fit the entire film. Like, he was seeing the whole thing as a musical. And I just needed to hear that to say, okay, we have to do this scene as a musical number. I've always wanted to do a horror film that stops dead in the middle and for no reason has a musical number and then goes back to being a horror film. In this case, it's about 20 minutes in, so it's probably, but it's as close as I'm ever going to get.
Oh, Uncle Lloyd was just amazing. And maybe like David Cronenberg should have put him in a dangerous method. Because like he was just great, like a Carl Jung or Freud, or like he was so funny, and we got to ask how Lloyd became involved.
Well, Lloyd had done a cameo for Slime City Massacre, and I had given him like some contacts and stuff when he shot the Newcomb High films here as well. I couldn't work on it because I was between Model Hunger and Battle Dogs, but you know, I've known him for a long time. I wouldn't say we were friends until, you know, this recent experience probably. Paul and I were kicking around different actors to play different parts, and I think at one point we were talking about Michael Thurber to play Dr. Foyn. But then I said, well, we could get Lloyd too, and we both agreed that if it was possible that would probably work pretty well. And he came out and, you know, was gracious as all get out and was really happy to have a bigger part, I think, and did a really good job. I pictured that he would come off as sort of a Mel Brooks type character, and I think that's exactly the case.
Well, Greg, I don't know if you know this, but I had the pleasure of speaking to Lloyd back in December, and he called you a god.
Well, who am I to argue with Lloyd?
If Lloyd calls you a deity, you're a deity, right?
He will be at Scarecon, by the way, but he's doing a Q&A opposite our screening, so he will not be able to see the film.
Oh, that's a shame.
At that time.
I was wondering what inspired, this is totally tangential and ridiculous, but what inspired the name for Buffalo Dreams? Is it just super ironic because... Because it's not the city that's normally associated with dreams. Or at least dreams being fulfilled.
Interesting. Well, there's a movie called Buffalo Dreams.
Okay.
Actually, I did a horror festival first for 3 years called Buffalo Screams. And I had two partners, and we had sort of a falling out with one partner. And the only way to keep the festival going, you know, without getting entangled in all sorts of, you know, unpleasantness, was to dissolve that one and reboot it, so to speak, as a multi-genre festival. And another person actually suggested that name. Well, I can't take any credit for it, but he said we could use it, and we have.
I'm going to speak for you, Chris.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah.
We both love Buffalo. You love Buffalo, don't you?
Yeah.
I love Buffalo. And it's just great to see a movie that was shot in Buffalo, where Buffalo played Buffalo.
For Newcomb High, it played Traumaville. For Battle Dogs, it played New York City. And for Model Hunger, it was just a nameless city. So I actually wanted to do a lot more with the Buffalo environment, but something interesting happened in that the place where we did our soundstage for the Gypsy Parlor, you have to do a one-day soundstage shoot to qualify for certain tax rebates, had a whole basement of unused offices. And I was like, no, this would be great for where Betty works, and this could be Foyn's office, and, you know, this could be multiple locations. So we actually shot half the film. I don't really want to say a studio, because it's like a building that is transitioning, let's just say. They're trying to develop it into a film facility, sort of an art center, I guess you would say. So and the alley was right in the back of that. So we shot at least half the film in sort of this area. Was the one time that I could drive to work every day and feel like I was going to a studio. So we because it was so centralized, we ended up not moving around the city as much as I probably would have liked. But there were other benefits.
And you're all native Buffalonians, am I correct in that assumption?
Correct.
Paul, just
in New York, yeah.
Yep. I mean, yeah. Well, you're a transplanted Manhattanite, eh, Greg?
Well, I grew up in this area, and then I lived in the New York City area for about 21 years, and then I came back this way.
And then you heard my Canadiana come out, and I said, "A."
so you guys are Canadian?
We are Canadian.
This interview is over.
Buffalo.
We do know. I mean, hey, you know, we love Buffalo, but you know, it's sort of like a big brother, little sister type thing with you guys and us. You know, us Torontonians. You know.
So I've been going to Toronto for 10 years now for Fan Expo, and I have a big, you know, I'm a novelist, and I think I have a bigger readership there than I do in the States. So I have a very strong feeling for Canada.
Most people in Buffalo don't really even consider Canada another country. It's just this natural thing.
Yeah.
I remember somebody said, "How many countries have you been to?" I'm like, "Well, not many. What about Canada? That's not another country." It's like a summer of Buffalo, isn't it?
Well, you know what? That's interesting.
You know, here in New York State, we have to pay tolls to get on any highway, so the border is no different.
Because the Dr. Thulu infomercial is absolutely hilarious. And
oh, God.
Chris.
You're not going to reference
it. I'm going to reference it.
Yeah, reference it.
Because here in Canada, you know, we get a lot of television stations from you guys, right?
And we get a lot of TV stations from Canada as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, ask.
I grew up with Hammy the Hamster and King of Kensington and a bunch of shows like that.
Degrassi.
I know your culture.
No, I was thinking like the ambulance chasing lawyers that populate Buffalo television. They're just so great, and we can't name them here for libel concerns. Can we?
I don't know.
Sam Mayes, Salino and Barnes, injury attorneys. Call 888-888-888.
Yeah, it's funny. When I moved back here, I could not get used to the fact that every other commercial was a lawyer. And now I just don't watch local TV that much. And you're not fazed by it.
So anyway, Jessica, I just want to—I don't think we're ignoring. I want to ask you about the when you do get the procedure done, and you're walking around with these gigantic bazungas, right? What was it like to walk around with those prosthetics?
Well, there was actually only 2 days in which I sat to get the actual prosthetics done. They were both days where they were going to be used on camera in a way where you would be able to see where they needed to look good. Otherwise, for the majority of the time, I had foam model after the prosthetic. Yeah. So it was, I really enjoyed scenes, where I was able to not wear them, where I was like pre-boob Betty. Like I really liked scenes like that. Cause it was like summertime. I mean, I didn't mind. They weren't like heavy, but it was one of those things where it was very sweaty, under the boob. And because I'm so socially awkward, apparently, when I'm caught off guard in interviews, there was, like, somebody who interviewed us during filming at Pulse.
Oh, my God,
and,
yes.
Like, they're like, oh, so how has it been working on Kelly? You know, like, and I never really had I've been interviewed a couple times for different things, but it was, like, the first time that I was interviewed about this, and, like, I had no, like, normal response, so like my first response was about boob sweat, and so it was just like that's like the only thing I was thinking of at that time, and so it was sweaty.
I thought you were going to mention the boob sniffer comment.
Oh, and the boob, yeah.
You gotta hear about
me
the boob
and Paul
sniffer.
Frequently talk about different fetishes that can arise out of stuff, and so that became one of our new fetishes that people might have later on in life. So it was okay walking around with them, but it was nice to be able to take them off.
You guys wouldn't know this, but I think the first time Jessica and Paul worked together was in a short film Paul helped write and direct called The Camper. And in that short film, he's a camp scout who gets raped by Jessica. And then in Dry Bones, she gets eaten by the succubus after they have sex. And now they get together in this, and now they just did a short film where they're together. So they're sort of the Fred and Gingers of horror in Buffalo right now. Correct with the most functional relationship, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Buffalo will always have the camper. We just kind of had worked, not directly together, but we had worked on a couple films, and the camper was actually when before Greg got involved, I hadn't actually seen Jessica act, and I was looking for somebody who might be able to play this lead,
And I was on set with for a film we were doing, and she had mentioned she had stage background. And again, very, very, very awkward myself. So trying to approach a girl I don't know and say, "See, your boob size is kind of the right size that I need. So would you act for me?" Jessica has a great sense of humor. She said, "I'd like to read the script." She read it, loved it, and then so when things got involved, that's why it was. And then I brought her onto the camper, and she just blew me away with her skill on the camper. So I was like, "This, I would like this girl to be the Betty that will."
It was actually my insanely inappropriate sense of humor that got Paul.
Well, that's what it first what made me think, like, okay, I could probably ask her without getting maced. That was what did that. And I believe, wasn't it boob sweat was one of the first jokes that we made? Were you talking about
boob sweat? It was actually sweat from somewhere else.
Oh, never, all sweat related, okay. No.
Well, I mean,
memories like the corner of my mind.
this is not a family friendly podcast. You guys can say whatever the hell you want, man. If you want to talk about ball sweat,
it's a family friendly movie.
Well,
yeah, we're trying to get that Disney side going.
Demigra, yeah.
The most awkward showing we're gonna ever have is the day my mom comes sees this. It's just gonna be. It's going to be hard for both of us. I want to sit next to her. When I first told her that this was going to be a real movie, she's an extremely supportive person. She's awesome. But there was that moment like, oh, Mom, this is going to be a real thing. And I got Greg Robertson who's really big, and he's going to make this a movie, and you're going to have to come see it. And we both had an oh, no moment because while she's supportive, she does not like horror, and she does not like the inappropriate humor, and mm-hmm. she's not going to like anything.
There's no inappropriate humor in this one. Come on.
She's my mom, and she's great.
There's no innuendo in this movie. There's no inappropriate humor. What are you talking about?
No. I mean, yeah, it's a very morose period piece, I think, but some people have been laughing, which I don't.
And if I can say, just because most of the listeners probably haven't seen Jessica in anything, mm-hmm. during the shooting, she was working two jobs.
Oh.
She's a teacher, and she was working for a penitentiary system.
Wow.
And she's a single mother, and you know, she had to work really, really hard on the shoot. And the first stuff we shot, actually, was the 2 days with Debbie as Dr. Thulu, so she had to, on her first day, be on her game and act with Debbie.
Well, I mean, Jessica, you were, again, I'm going to reiterate how incredible you are. I mean, I think, you know, as great as the script is and how funny the movie is, it would not have worked if your performance was not so relatable and just so wonderful and just, as I said before, charming.
Mm-hmm.
So are you ready for your rocket ship to superstardom, Jessica?
Well, I appreciate the kind words. That's very nice of you to say. I don't know how to respond. I don't know. I'm really awkward with responses.
I was going to say earlier that unlike Betty, Jessica is not clueless, but she obviously just shot that down.
No, it's very, I had a lot of fun, and I really put a lot of myself into playing Betty, and the fact that I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about my portrayal of the character is a really, really nice, and very much appreciated, I just appreciate it very much. It's something that, you know, I don't know, it's strange to me. So, like, when I hear, like, certain things, you know, I accept it. I'm always very, I mean, Paul knows this more so about me. I can get very self-critical, like, about stuff regarding performance. Mm-hmm. But the fact that I've gotten so much positive feedback and I feel like, you know, the work that I put in paid off, and so I really appreciate the kind words from everybody. There's a lot of gratitude there on my part.
No, that's great. Question for Paul here. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool, awful police procedural show addict. You know, Law and Order, SVU, all this crap. I loved the cop characters, like one of whom looked a little bit like a sort of a sad sack Gene Hackman.
Oh, Michael Harris.
No, it was just how did you come up with that? What was the inspiration?
That was actually inspired by the actor who played the part. He had said to me that he always wanted to play this cop that, you know, that's retiring gruff cop, and I thought, wouldn't it be hilarious? Why don't we take this cliche? I love taking cliches and just turning them on their ears. So I wanted these two just utter cliches, like walking targets, as it will. You know, him being just that week away from retirement, and the other guy being this young rookie trying to get his wife pregnant, mm-hmm. kind of stuff, and this young, happy, eager rookie. So I decided to just push these cliches as far as possible. That was the inspiration for them.
Well, not just being a week away from retirement, he was pretty much a walking corpse, I mean, even beforehand. Absolutely hilarious stuff. Anyway, Jessica, I have to say, it was an absolute pleasure speaking to you. I'm forced to say goodbye to you, and after a short break, we're going to talk to Michael Thurber, who plays the villainous Mr. Raquel or Rockwell, depending on who's pronouncing the name. But Jessica, again, congratulations. And you did an incredible job.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
It's been our absolute pleasure, Jessica.
Chins up, top down. Hit the speed bumps going downtown. Cadillac flapjack slapping in the breeze. You can hear me scream. Whoa, whoa.
Michael, we've been talking Killer Rock, a movie that I believe you're in. You play the villainous Mr. Raquel or Mr. Rockwell, depending upon who's pronouncing your name. And we've been talking with Greg and Paul and Jessica, and they've had nothing but terrible things to say about you up to this point.
Oh, well, that was
very nice.
And now that you're here, we can really let it out. There you go. Just pull out all the stuff.
So I think one thing that was interesting was Paul was saying that you were originally in consideration to play the role that Lloyd Kaufman originally played. Were you aware of that?
He doesn't know that.
Oh, no, we love the kind of
the truth shall be known. The truth shall be revealed. All will be made clear. Well, we had worked with Michael on Model Hunger, directed by Debbie Rashan,
right.
And had wanted to work with him again, and most of the films here are too low budget to bring somebody out, so we had a little more money for this one, and we knew we wanted him. We were just debating which character we wanted him for.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
So what made you decide to...
I thought I was handed an absolute church piece of role, and I went to town with it. I had the really time of my life with it. It was a lot of fun. They treated me like a king, and I can't be more grateful to them.
You know, if you're standard, if you think you got treated like a king, really, Michael, you can do better.
Yes. Yes.
You're setting the bar too low.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I mean,
from the time I set foot in Buffalo until the time they booted me on the plane, I had the time of my life. I really did. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Michael, your character...
what a wonderful script. I mean, the script was spot on. It was very easy to fall into the character because the script was so well written.
Michael, your character, Mr. Rockwell, I mean, you go from sort of bubbling and aloof to evil and malevolent. I was wondering, which is the real you?
I probably exposed more of my real self in this movie.
you didn't show that part of the film where you expose yourself.
Oh, yeah. That's on the cutting room floor. Is that what you think?
That's the private stack, right?
Yeah. Huh? All the private
stack. Yeah, like Rockwell, we have our own library. Yeah.
I would say Mr. Rockwell is probably one of the more fun characters that I've played in this week all show. It allowed me to do some of the comedy stuff that I love to do and be mean and sinister towards the end that I love to do as well. So it gave me the whole broad spectrum, which was great. Like I said, it's all based on the script. You're only as good as what you're handed. And I was handed a nice role and a wonderful cast to work with. I mean, Jessica, the love of my life. She's right up there with Debbie. Debbie is
the other love of your life.
That's right. Yeah. And Debbie knows it too. I tell her constantly. And I tell Jessica all the time too. We had an awful lot of fun doing that movie.
Mm-hmm. How come I never hear
from you? Yeah, I'm still a little hot too. Well, but you can't be the love one. You're my breakfast buddy.
Okay, I'll take it. Michael actually created his character. I mean, it wasn't in the script, all the facial expressions and the weird mannerisms. And I mean, this is all stuff he brought to the role. Mm-hmm. And we were just mesmerized by it. And then he would say, concerned, do you like what I'm doing? We're like, yes!
Yeah.
Greg, I remember you yelled at me one point.
Don't stop!
You yelled at me one point because I couldn't keep a straight face when we were doing rehearsals. Like, Paul, can you just deliver your lines? I'm like, I can't. I'm laughing at him. It's his fault.
The constant reassurance, I think, comes from my stage acting in that you have to, you know, the actor always hoping that they're doing a good job. And with live audience, you get that constant feedback all during the show. But in the movie, you don't get it as much in the movie. You don't really get it that much. And I wanted to be sure it was everything that you had wanted, that you were envisioning for the character. I wanted to give you as much as I possibly could. Always give them too much, and then they can tone you down. But,
yeah, this wasn't the type of the movie for toning down. So, I mean, we just loved all
of it. Oh, no.
Michael's face can do things like Jim Carrey. I mean, he's got a very, very animated expression. And Michael, I don't know if you know this, you were kind of like the major crush on this film, like all the girls who were just, my friend Brittany who played Sandra, kept asking, like, Michael is the greatest ever, and just, you know, writing, Mrs. Michael Thurber on her paper, it was...
Oh, I was just saying, the stage keeps coming up in our conversation here. So you guys, like, veterans of, like, Chekhov and Ibsen or like Tom Stoppard or something? What kind of stage background do you guys have?
Well, I've been doing theater since I was in high school, and that was 100 years ago. And I run my own theater company here in Rhode Island. I'm the founder and artistic director of the theater company in Rhode Island. For 31 years I've been doing it. I direct them all and I'm in most of them. So I have quite an extensive theater background.
So,
that's what I originally wanted to do, and then it was Sarah Nicklin who actually got me into the movie biz. Just on a whim, you know, and something you'd really like to do. I thought it's the whole side of show business that I'd never attempted before, and I was thinking it was going to be, you know, like third spear bearer or fourth whore or something like that, standing in the background. But
that was originally my one thing, on the fourth whore.
And it's just kind of taken off, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful experience. Like I said, a whole side of show business that I've never attempted, and I love every minute of it. And I see why so many stage actors go into it, because it allows you to bring up another facet of your character.
Michael's done all the classics. Frankenstein, Dracula, forget that stage stuff. Richard Mark Griffin has been casting him in these films he makes as all these classic horror characters.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I know that you have a following out there. I keep telling him, you know, he just needs to be in, like, one big horror film, one big SAG horror film, and he could be the new Vincent Price.
Well, I mean,
when I first met Michael, I hadn't seen his performance. I was giving him a ride when he was up here doing my longer, and his train was late, and we had breakfast, and he was just this great guy and got along with him wonderful. We became Facebook friends, and then I saw one of his movies, Exhumed, which is just an amazing, amazing movie. And I think I met Patrick right after. I'm like, Michael, I'm glad I met you before that movie, because I would not have the guts to talk to you after that.
You're out of my league, dude.
I am so proud of that film.
So, Greg, is it
so
safe
proud, to say? Yeah, it's a fantastic film. I was lucky enough to see it before he came out from Mama Hunger, so I had high expectations. Mama Hunger, I mean, just so you know, his character, Debbie, who directed it, totally changed. She said he doesn't need any of this dialogue. He can do this whole role physically.
Mm-hmm.
Just through facial expressions and stuff, and that's what he did. And, you know, that film's going to be on the film festival circuit the same time we are, and
right,
people
right.
are going to see him in these two completely different parts.
Mm-hmm. Well,
absolutely.
Greg, I wanted to ask you about Buffalo Dreams. You're talking about Model Hunger, Debbie Rochon's Model Hunger, and Michael, you're in that as well. This is ostensibly our Killer Act podcast, but let's talk a little bit about Model Hunger.
I worked on that film.
What would you like to know?
I'd like to, Michael, tell us about the character you play in Model Hunger.
The interesting thing about Model Hunger going into it was the only person I knew was Debbie.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anybody else. And I didn't know who they were or what capacity they were in genre. And I found out over the course of the short time that I was there, the wonderful Tiffany Shepard and my God, the great Lynn Lowry, and I hadn't worked with Carmine Temple Bianco, but to be with all of these people and Voltaire, all of the people that she had in that movie, I find out after the fact, and it's the same situation I had with Debbie in Exhumed. I had no idea who she was, and she had such a striking personality when we read through the script, and I thought, well, this one's going to be fun to work with, you know? And she was beyond fun to work with. She was just an absolute delight, and when she ever contacted me to do this, she was the only person I knew. I was going in only knowing her and trusting her, both with what she was telling me about the script and what she was going to do with the script. And it was beyond my expectations. Such a wonderful film. I mean, my God, Lynn Lowry is out of this world in this movie. And Tiffany holds her own with Lynn. And every single character in that movie is beyond, knocking it out of the park right from the get-go. And being with Wolfgang was a joy. He was an absolute joy to work with. As was Chris. I mean, Chris was wonderful, too. I worked out with him spottingly on Model Hunger. He was there occasionally, but Wolfgang was wonderful, and Chris was just as wonderful to work with. It was such a great experience. Every time I've been to the whole time of this football, it's been wonderful. Oh, and Greg, I mean, come on. beyond what you would expect. He's a fantastic director and an excellent producer. I mean, he had us right down to the minute every single day with no wasted time, and I appreciate that, especially in the theater. There's so many directors that waste your time. I don't waste your time. I don't want you to waste my time. And Greg doesn't. I mean, whether he's director or producer, doesn't matter. It's right down the line. Bing, here we go. And every time we start getting a little silly on Killer Rack, Paul and I, or Jessica and I, we just bring it right back to business. Let's get this done, and then we'll have our fun. And that's how it works. And you'll see the finished product.
Well, Killer Rack is absolutely outstanding. We both love it. I cannot wait to see Model Hunger. Actually, Greg, I do plan on attending the Buffalo Dreams Film Festival this year, if you'll have me.
Festival passes for you guys, absolutely.
Awesome. I'm going to hold you to that, and our listeners will as well.
After that review you gave us, hell yeah.
Yeah.
We'll just pretend that we're making that deal now.
That's right.
Well, I mean, you know, what can I say? The movie is an absolute joy. I mean, it's got everything. It's got, you know, laughs, incredible characters, great music, some of that music, you know, we played in this podcast. Fantastic effects. We didn't even get much of a chance to talk about the practical effects, but they're unbelievable. Actually, Greg, let me ask you very, very quickly if you could tell us about these special effects.
Yeah. The main effects guy was a guy named Eric Zemecki, who's mm-hmm. been working on my stuff since Fun City Massacre. And Eric works incredibly hard and incredibly long hours, and very often, because he's, you know, usually not working with assistants, it comes time to shoot the thing and some disaster happens, you know, that holds us up for hours, and he's under pressure. And on Slime City Massacre, he was under so much pressure, he was drinking Red Bulls all day, he actually passed out and blood was coming out of his nose.
Wow.
And it turned out that's sort of a normal thing for him. But where I'm going with this is, I think after years of working together, this is the one where he really outdid himself with his sculptures and the effects, these puppets he built, mm-hmm. these different mm-hmm. puppets. I'm really proud of them. And, you know, a couple of the reviews, I'm glad I have the opportunity to say this, have lightheartedly made reference to sci-fi channel-type effects at the end of the film. They're referring to the tentacles that come out. Mm-hmm. But those aren't cheap sci-fi channel CGI. That's actually stop-motion animation that wow. Brett Piper did. So even the stuff that looks like it's digital is handcrafted stuff. And, you know, I have a fan base for Slime City, and I know that those people want practical effects.
Right.
So most of our effects are practical and took a lot of work, and some of them are enhanced digitally, like the breast appliances you see Jessica wearing. They weren't smooth at all. They were peeling at the ends, and, you know, a human being has to breathe, and that causes damage to these things. So our digital artist, Chris Cosgrave, then did a fantastic job smoothing those out.
Well, I mean, it looked absolutely seamless and fantastic. Actually, the boobs, if I may say so, it kind of gave me, I got a bit of a Deadly Spawn vibe from them. And that's a compliment.
Absolutely. You know, I managed a theater in New York City where that film had its premiere. I think when Eric and I were discussing it with Paul, he had said the mouth would be sort of like Tremors, but we have that Deadly Spawn type thing in mind as well. And, you know, I knew very much that I wanted to show as little of them as possible mm-hmm. until that end and then go all out for the climax. So I think by the time you get there, you're convinced that you're just watching a comedy with some light horror elements, and then we really hit the viewers with it at the end.
Well, right. You know, it's funny because, I mean, I know this is the quote-unquote third act climax. I don't want to talk too much about it because, I mean, it really is something to behold. I mean, it's a pure, unbridled, unhinged, incredible. You know what? It might be the most fun finale I've seen in a long time.
Thanks. I mean, it was, I think in the script it was like 5 pages, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, very sparsely described. You know, she runs down the street having a rampage, grabs this woman and does this, she grabs this one, and the sequence that it is now is 12 minutes long, and it took us 4 long
wow.
nights to shoot. And, you know, on films, you're always saying, let's hurry up, we're losing light, because you want to shoot in the daytime with the sunshine. On this one, I was looking up at the sky, watching it slowly
yeah.
right at that sunrise, it was like a burst. And it felt like a vampire. I was trying to do it in 2 days, and I knew we'd probably go 3, and we ended up going 4, because there were just so many characters and so much mayhem going on.
Uh-huh. And, you know, talking about the references that we were mentioning before, and again, I only picked this up, on my third viewing, and that was the nods to Tromaville and Frankenhooker. But the one thing
Yes, you would also see Slime City on one of those garbage cans,
mm-hmm.
but Rod Dyrick, our partner, advised me not to outline the lettering so that you could see them, so now you don't see them.
And the one thing
there's
that,
enough Slime City in there anyway.
The one thing I saw today, and it finally came into me, and I don't want to reveal too much, but poor Roy Frumkes. You know what I mean?
Poorer than you know, because Roy came out and he said, listen, I just want to let you know, I'm sick. And you know, Roy's not a young guy anymore, and he's a bit of a germaphobe, and he showed up and he was really sick and he did not want to go outside. I was like, well, you came all this way and your scene has to be shot, and I don't mind revealing that the gag involves, you know, him dying in a ghastly manner.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought him out, we put on the appliance, you know, for the gag, and we brought him out, we doused him in milk, And then he went back inside, and Rod came out and he said, "Oh, we got a problem. Roy doesn't want to come back out. He wants to know if we can shoot the rest of the scene inside." Meanwhile, we've shot in an alley, very carefully lit. And I was like, "No, he's got to get out here." I gave him no opportunity. So he came out, and we shot the rest of it as quickly as we could. And I think it's going to be a very funny scene for his fans. Mm-hmm. Michael, you're unfamiliar, but Roy did a film called Street Trash, which is a huge cult film. Mm-hmm. And that's about winos who drink alcohol and then melt. And so he's the milk victim. So that's a very specific reference to his film. And when he runs away screaming, Jessica says there's no substitute, he also wrote a franchise, an action franchise called The Substitute.
Is Michael joining you guys in Verona?
No. We've got all locals who are coming. Mm-hmm. And actually, anyone who is making a big trip, I would probably encourage to see it, you know, at a festival that's showing in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Scarecon is a huge horror convention, and I'm not sure what the screening room will be. I know it'll be a blast.
So, I mean,
maybe Michael will come up to see it at Buffalo Dreams, because Debbie will be here.
There you go. There you go.
Then you can have Jessica on one arm, Debbie on the other, and look very debonair on the red carpet.
And if
I should die a happy man.
And if it's any incentive, Michael...
The young girl's just screaming and throwing her undergarments at him.
If it's any incentive, Michael, I'll be there as well, but I'll be on Greg's arm or something, so...
I love Canada, but that's taking it a bit too far.
We're very liberal here, you know that, right, Greg?
I wanted to say, Michael's performance actually affected the editing somewhat,
mm-hmm.
because he would do these bits... Like just when he walked out of a scene or something, and I would have to choose between keeping his bit or losing some of the other actors. Little things going on at the start of the next scene, and invariably I kept his bits because it was just so funny.
Oh, there you go. Very nice. Thank you.
So you can expect some nasty emails from your co-star. Whoever listens to the podcast. just a funny anecdote, you know, Bob Bozak plays the Igor character who works for Debbie, and there's this funny scene where Debbie is talking to Jessica, and Bob is behind her, and he's got the hunchback, and he's got this sonogram thing in his hand, and he's doing this shtick, unbeknownst to her, where he's just running it over his hump through the whole scene and making these funny expressions, and she had no idea he was doing it. And as soon as I laughed and said what he was doing, she says, "Oh, are you stealing my scene?" It was so funny.
Well, I mean, as I said,
Bob is also in Model Hunger.
The movie is a blast from start to finish, and so we mentioned the world premiere, and I know you're rolling it out in festivals. Hamilton, right, Greg?
Yep. As far as I know, Hamilton is our one Canadian screening, so we will be very happy with that. There's a chance, maybe Toronto After Dark. We'll see.
For our listeners that want to see Killer Rack, what can they do?
Go to our Facebook page and just watch worlds of any festival that we're getting into. We've announced three so far. We've gotten into five. We're waiting to hear back from almost 40, you know, all over the world. So mm-hmm. hopefully there'll be a lot to come. Yeah. This film is a comedy, and I think comedy should be seen with an audience.
Right.
And there's no chance of a theatrical release. So we decided going into this that we were going to hit the festival circuit harder than I've ever attempted with any of the other films.
Wow.
I only regret that, you know, I don't have the bank account to travel wherever it plays. We're mm-hmm. screaming in Ireland, and I know we'll be in Kentucky and Washington, D.C. I'm not going to name the festivals, but we should have a pretty big presence in Spain and hopefully England.
Amazing.
I think I'm a genius, Grant.
Well, it's incredible. Like, I mean, this has been, you know, I remember 2 years ago, my first ever encounter with Killer Rack, Greg, when I saw you at Fan Expo, and, you know, being a huge fan of your other films, I went up to you and I saw you had a little flyer for Killer Rack, and I see those two words put together, Killer Rack. I saw the image, which I'm actually wearing my t-shirt right now as we speak, and I was like, I'm sold. And having seen this movie about 2 years later, it basically lived up to my expectations completely.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it's funny because you're outlining just how long it takes and how much hard work it takes. You know, I know guys who make their livings doing this, and they produce, direct, line produce 10 movies a year, and I don't know how they do it, because the gestation period and the raising the money and putting it together and just doing the scheduling, it's so much work and takes so long to get to this point. And that's why it is exciting that we're starting, you know, our screenings now, because this is where it actually is born. You know, it's where we let it loose and see how people like it.
But you know what? I mean, it's all up there on the screen. I mean, you know, we've talked. Michael, you're fantastic. Jessica is fantastic. Paul, you're fantastic. We talked about Debbie. We talked about. We talked about Lloyd. I mean,
a wonderful job.
Yeah, I mean, Mike.
Absolutely wonderful job.
And we didn't even talk about Michael here, Alexander S. McBride. I mean, everybody just totally committed. Incredible stuff, and just a great film. So I really want to thank you guys for chatting with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having us.
I would like to very quickly acknowledge Brooke Lewis.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The voice of the Boots.
Because
she's not seen on camera, and because the talking boobs is sort of being kept somewhat of a secret by reviewers, she's not getting any attention yet. Once the film's out, I know she will, but she's been a huge supporter of the film from the very beginning, and she's very funny as the voice of the Boots.
Any final words before we sign off, guys?
Send money.
I think the Indiegogo campaign is over.
It's never over. We're just, you know.
Before he's for Killer Rock.
Yeah, if I see a fan, actually, you know, just slip me an envelope. I'll bring you a Tim's. You know, I'll take a cup of Tim's.
Yeah. We'll do. Thank you so much, Michael, for talking to us. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thank you. Nice talking to you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, man.